Welcome to the Corlin Economics Report, a weekly look at financial and political topics relating to asset-based investing. Guests on this program pay no fees to appear, and guests and hosts disclose any equity interest in companies profiled. Now, the Corlin Economics Report.
Hey everyone, welcome in to the weekend edition of the KE Report. My name is Corey Fleck and I'm your host for this first hour. I want to wish everybody a happy Labor Day, long weekend, and well, wish everybody the best as kids start to go back to school next week, at least here in Canada, and who knows, maybe the world starts to get back to a little bit more of a sense of normal, but that's a pretty big maybe as we continue to see a slew of mixed data around the world, especially when it comes to COVID-19. We're going to focus a lot on the markets and metals with a couple company updates at the tail end of this first hour. But first and foremost, I am chatting with Mike Larson. He is the editor of the Safe Money Report. You can also follow Mike on Twitter at RealMikeLarson. Now, Mike, let's start off with the U.S. equity markets and what I think we can maybe call the dot-com bubble 2.0, where we have seen high-flying tech names continue to lead the markets higher. However, on Thursday, and we're recording it later in the day on Thursday, we're seeing a pretty big correction in the tech names, drawing down the broad averages. It's looking like it's going to be the worst day since June for the U.S. equity markets, but hey, we haven't hit a circuit breaker, and remember those days when we hit circuit breakers almost day after day. Mike, your thoughts on the volatility this week as markets were grinding higher and now on Thursday, pretty aggressively reversed.
Yeah, I mean, we've seen a run for the ages in the last few months in tech specifically, or tech, the sector overall, and then some of these specific names like Tesla and so on. The overall sector, you're up 70-80% in the span of a handful of months. You're talking about some of these companies that have put on 200-400% or more in terms of gains year to date in the last 6 months, really since that March bottoming in the market. You probably don't need me to tell you that's not normal. I mean, these are the kinds of outsized gains, especially when they're extremely concentrated in one sector, that we truly haven't seen since, the late 1999, early 2000 timeframe. I mean, obviously, I was active in the markets back then. I remember what it was like. I worked at a dot-com firm, in fact. And so I saw a lot of that stuff going on firsthand. And I really honestly think the comparisons are incredibly apt. With that said, once you get into that rarefied air, it's kind of like on Mount Everest, where you get over a certain height in terms of climbing from Camp 1 to Camp 2 to Camp 3 and so on. And you end up in the death zone where, you screw something up at 10,000 feet over sea level, it's not a problem. You screw something up at 27,000 feet above sea level, you're in a world of hurt and you can end up dying. That's kind of similar to what's been going on in the market here. I mean, you're in rarefied air where there's so many people piling so aggressively into such a small group of stocks, and the gains are so enormous, the momentum so powerful, that if you hit that trap door, you hit anything that kind of pulls the rug out from under it, pick your metaphor, you can see big drops in a short period of time. I mean, some of these tech names were getting nuked for 10-20% in a day on Thursday. And again, that's not a typically normal market type move, especially absent a real catalyst. I mean, if you look at the overall market and the news flow this week, there really wasn't anything specific. It's not like some mega cap tech company like Apple came out and gave an earnings warning or something fundamental happened in it with one of these big names, Facebook or Tesla, whatever. It's really just that I think we hit sort of an air pocket in an extremely overbought, extremely overfollowed sector of the market. And that's when you get these big, sharp declines. Now, the real question is, what does it mean going forward? I don't have a better answer than we'll see. Clearly, at past major turning points, we've seen similar extreme volatility. Back in the 1999-2000 timeframe when things started to fall, you had days where the NASDAQ was down 5, 6, 7% in a day. Then you'd have rallies where it'd be up 3, 4, 5%. You started to see a real increase in chop, a real increase in volatility, and that signaled that the bigger picture turn was at hand. Now, that may be what's happening here, or it may just be a violent correction in the midst of an extremely powerful rally. I wouldn't get overly aggressive either way as an investor. You don't want to go hog wild trying to short this part of the market, and you don't want to really say, oh, gee, we had one or two down days, we're down 10% total, let's load up the boat and buy a bunch of these stocks because they're already, even with the decline, up 70-80% in a few months. So really, I think it's a good time to step back to the sidelines, start looking at your portfolio. And frankly, if you're way overloaded or way overexposed to these sectors, this is a great time to lighten up. You know, you might have lost 10% from your peak account value, but if you're up 60, 70, 80%, still, I mean, what's wrong with taking some chips off the table, so to speak, and start getting into some of the sectors that actually held up. If you look back at a day like Wednesday, tech started to lag, but a lot of money wasn't pulling out of the market entirely until Thursday. It was starting to go into sectors that were more defensive, utilities, consumer staples, pharmaceuticals. Some of those names had actually a pretty good day on Wednesday. And they did okay in a down market on Thursday. So again, those are some of the things you can look at. You know, diversify your portfolio a little bit. Look into some of these things with yield, with dividend income, and that tend to hold up better in downturns. And then wait and see how things go. The market's come a long way in a relatively short period of time. It's a good time to pause, you know, a pause that refreshes. And then we'll see if it actually is a pause that refreshes or a pause that turns into something worse.
Yeah, Mike, I think this whole concept of the markets at a certain altitude or a trap door opening up and a free fall happening, people are worried about that. I understand why, because that brings down almost every sector if we have something similar to what happened in March. However, with central banks as easy as they are, and quite frankly, data around the world already weak, do you think that central banks will have the ability to lessen some of the drastic moves down similar to March?
Well, that's the reason why I don't want to get too aggressive, you know, and say, okay, this is it. This is it. Greatest shorting opportunity of a lifetime. Let's short stocks. Let's buy put options. Let's become millionaires when the market goes to the downside. I think it's way too early for that. Central banks obviously have been a key driver of what's been happening in terms of removing risk from asset values. Their actions have generally failed miserably, not just in the short term, but in the long term, in terms of impacting the real economy, getting growth notably higher, getting inflation notably higher. I mean, the Fed and other foreign central banks have missed their previous 2% target for more than a decade, and now they're trying to throw more of the same monetary spaghetti at the wall to hit a higher than 2% target effectively. And, you know, we know that doesn't work for the real economy. It doesn't mean they don't keep doing it anyway because they've got nothing else to do. But we do know that that tends to inflate assets. And that does also give or makes investors emboldened to feel that the Fed has their back. So why not just speculate on every reckless piece of garbage paper that comes along their desk because it's going to go up in value? I think you've seen all of this excessive asset inflation in large part because of that sort of don't fight the Fed spirit. Unfortunately, eventually, at some point, you need the underlying fundamentals to play catch up. You need there to be some recoupling from assets after an extensive decoupling with the real economy. And that may be where people are waiting to see now. The data has certainly improved. When you look at sort of jobless claims and retail spending data, it's improved from, you know, where we were at the depths of the downturn in March to now. But we're still elevated relative to where we were before COVID ever struck, before anybody heard of it. We still have a high relative to history level of jobless claims, initial jobless claims in this country. We still have not gotten, you know, people back to work as if nothing happened in many sectors in the real economy. We still have, you know, things like travel, leisure, hotels, cruise lines, airlines, restaurants, all that stuff that are still struggling badly, even though the tech sector and the remote working trend has helped benefit some of the tech companies. So broadly speaking, the economy is still not in a great place. But asset markets have been trading like it's the best economy since the 1990s. And that leaves us in a sort of vulnerable state where we have to see, can central bank policy make up for everything, or are people going to start and look under their feet and be like, geez, there's nothing but air. Maybe it's time to start selling. And that's kind of where we're at. And again, I don't want to be overly ridiculously positive, like, oh, this is the greatest correction. You've got a chance, buy for the next 50% to the upside. But I also don't want to be overly negative yet and say there's nothing they can do. This market's going to fall apart. Get short. It's more of a, okay, we've got this pause, get a little bit more defensive, take some of your winners off the table, raise a little cash and see, let the market maybe tip its hand a little bit here.
Yeah, protect some of those gains. I completely agree with you on that one, Mike. One comment that you made, though, is that investors have the ability or have had the ability to say the Fed's got our back, so I'm going to use these low interest rates to take this money and buy whatever garbage I can. We've seen some, even bankrupt companies bounce from some of these lows. But in all fairness, people, it seems like, have been using this cheap money and buying just the leading tech stocks, which at least they have revenue. They do seem to be still doing fairly well.
Well, you know, it's interesting when you go back and, you know, a lot of people think, oh, in the dot-com era, it was just all these garbage companies that had no money, no profits, and, you know, we're going to sell pet food online and lose money on every sale but make it up on volume. And there was certainly a lot of that junk going up. But if you go back to that time frame, you also had basically the equivalent of today's Facebook and Google and Apple that go up every day. You had those same big mega cap tech companies that had real businesses back then that were going up every day and were trading at ridiculous volumes. I mean, Cisco Systems, Sun Microsystems, Microsoft even. A lot of those, it wasn't just the garbage that was flying. It was also the big cap tech companies that did have real businesses. So that's another parallel that's very similar to today. I mean, it's not like Facebook is going to go broke tomorrow like some of these money losing companies might eventually, but you have to remember that same exact thing happened. We got to a point where, you know, even big mega cap tech companies were being radically overvalued and more money was piling into a smaller and smaller group of stocks. And then it just sort of collapsed under its own weight. I don't know if what we've seen this week is the start of a new sort of process like what happened in 2000, but certainly we have a lot of parallels between what happened back then and what we have now. And again, if you have those huge gains, increased volatility like this could signal a trend change, and it's why you want to maybe take some of those chips off the table.
All right, Mike, let's switch focus to two other sectors or markets, one being the U.S. dollar, which has been and still is in a pretty pronounced downtrend. As we're recording this, the dollar is under 93 on the dollar index, but earlier this week it dipped below 92. I also want you to compare that weakness in the U.S. dollar to commodities broadly, because it's one aspect that I've touched on here is crude oil holding still above $40 a barrel. That seems kind of crazy to me, but also copper holding above $3. This is higher than copper was trading even before the pandemic. And yes, I get there has been some supply destruction out there, but in no way is the demand picture or equation even close to where it was at the beginning of this year. How are the dollar and commodities, the ability of commodities to hang up fairly strongly, how are you viewing this?
Sure. I think, you know, there are real world things going on and there are also financial market things going on. The Fed is clearly trying to devalue the dollar by doing these swap lines with foreign central banks at the height of the crisis, by doing things like printing money and by talking, you know, up long term, trying to talk up long term inflation and, you know, trying to talk down a bid for safety in the short term. All of that is part of the Fed's plan to try and, you know, pump up inflation a little bit and pump up assets. And some of that spills over into the market for paper commodities, futures markets and things like that. You know, it's no real secret or no surprise that you see some markets like crude or copper or stocks or lumber or gold or, you know, fill in the blank, basically all be kind of trading in the same general pattern, even as the U.S. dollar has been falling. That being said, there are real physical demand and supply issues that affect certain parts of the commodities market. Certainly, if you look at what's happened in the lumber industry and the lumber pricing in the last several weeks or several months, that's also because demand in housing and home purchases has been so strong. So that's, you know, a combination of the financial impact plus also the real economy impact. And then you have assets like gold and silver to a lesser degree that, you know, are more of a sort of a monetary impact. People want protection from monetary devaluation and, you know, the Fed's efforts to print money. So you've got that part of the commodity market, the precious metals market, do well. So, again, broadly speaking, there's different individual things that drive each subsector in commodities, but there's also that broader trend of asset inflation, dollar devaluation, and so on. I think that, you know, if I had to say what I like the most, it's still precious metals in that sector. I still think the real economy demand for things like gasoline, jet fuel, and so on remains weak. That's not going to change. Some of the, you know, even though there's been a slight rebound off the low, you look at what some of these airlines are saying, their year-over-year demand is still down 80-85%. Now, that's not 99% like it was back in March, but it's still a pretty ugly number. And you can see that in similar things like cruise ships and so on. And let's be honest, if more people are working from home, I know I've certainly put a lot fewer miles on my car in the last 6 months than I did in the 6 months prior to that. And, you know, to spread that impact around not just the U.S. or not just my backyard, but Canada and the rest of the world being impacted by COVID. And that's going to have an impact on things like energy demand. So those are the forces that are working there. And I still think, you know, if you try and look for the best opportunity, the types of subsectors that are going to hold up the best, I still think it's the precious metals, because they have that monetary benefit. They benefit from falling dollar. They benefit from a need for what I call chaos insurance in times of higher market volatility. Central banks are allocating more money to the sector, and individual and institutional investors are doing the same. So that subsector probably has the best combination of underlying fundamentals, rather than just sort of this funny money effect that tends to inflate all assets at the same time.
Yeah, which this funny money effect has been, well, at hold of these markets. How do you view this current correction in the precious metals? Gold still very much range bound, but has pulled back from its highs, at least on the spot market, all-time highs. Silver, that's also pulling back, but silver was outperforming gold there for a little bit in the last couple weeks.
Yeah, again, you know, to me, it looks like nothing more than a correction of a market that got pretty heated, and I still wouldn't change my big picture opinion that we're only in sort of the fifth inning of this this precious metals bull market. I think, you know, it began in late 2018. I still think it's got some time and a lot of price to run. So again, I think investors want to still be buying pullbacks and stick with that bull market mentality, which is what you couldn't stick with between, you know, 2011 and 2018, give or take. I mean, once you had that initial fall, 2011, 2012, you know, into early 2013, really, you know, there was nothing much to do there. But now it's bull market mentality until something's proven otherwise. And I just don't see any reason to change that thesis.
Yeah, fair enough. So it's crazy to think about, but we're in September, and this is at the end of September going to be the end of the third quarter. Obviously, with these higher metals prices, you would expect precious metals miners to generate some very good numbers. Is there any opportunity here to maybe play some of these earnings reports ahead of when they actually come out from some of the major mining companies?
You know, again, they've all, a lot of the names have generally paused along with the underlying metals, which is to be expected. You know, some of these junior miners, for example, have come a long way in the last 12 to 18 months. But I don't see any reason why you don't want to continue to hold what you own and why you don't want to be taking advantage of some of these pullbacks to get that exposure. I mean, we all know that the miners are going to be leveraged to the, you know, how the underlying or leverage performers versus the underlying metal. And I think that there's some of these companies that, you know, are doing smart things. They took advantage of the downturn to, you know, work on sort of their asset profile and work on their exploration and so on. And that long period of stagnation and bear market behavior weeded out a lot of the junk names. So while you still have some froth and some companies out there that don't really know what they're doing or that are just sort of trying to jump on the bandwagon, there's plenty of solid names, solid operators and companies that have a very solid long-term outlook if this metals bull market is, you know, still has 4 or 5 innings left to go.
Yeah, hopefully it still does have that long to go. Final comments here, Mike. When you take a step back, watching either headlines, market moves, really anything around the world that you think is most noteworthy to pay attention to, what is on your radar for, let's say, this month?
Well, sure. I mean, obviously, you know, we're going to have the U.S. presidential election coming up in November, and, you know, the race is really getting kind of heated and ugly. So that may be part of the reason why we're seeing a bit more volatility. People don't know who's going to win, even though Biden had been doing very well. Some of the polling suggests that gap is narrowing with Trump. People may be looking to hedge their bets a little bit there. So that's something I would keep my eye on, and keep my eye on the sort of inflationary expectations. I mean, Powell and the Fed tried to once again convince the market that, yeah, we're going to, you know, raise our inflation target instead of hitting straightforward 2, we're going to aim for average 2. And the bond market played along for a few days where interest rates went up a little bit, bond prices went down a little bit, inflation pricing in the bond market picked up. But now that's going away again because people know this kind of happy talk doesn't really change the reality, which is that for long-term demographic, structural, economic, and debt-based reasons, we're just getting asset inflation and not real economy inflation. If that were to change, that's going to contribute to sort of the shift here. People are going to move out of, are going to try and get more inflation protection, you know, look to get out of treasuries and into other things and so on. But I don't think long term that's really going to work. So I would just say keep your eye on the bond market, keep your eye on what's going on in politics, and, you know, keep your eye on the tech sector in particular to see if this turns in from a short term correction into something more serious.
All right, Mike, going to wrap it up there. I recommend following Mike on Twitter, again, @RealMikeLarson. If you want any more information on Mike's newsletter, The Safe Money Report, please email me, fleck@kereport.com, and I will get you in touch with Mike and his team. Mike, thanks for your time this weekend. Have a great rest of your weekend and a great long weekend.
Thank you.
Al Corlin's firm, A.B. Corlin & Associates Incorporated, provides consulting services to public companies on matters of regulatory compliance. To find out more, follow the link from www.kereport.com. The Corlin Economics Report will be back after this brief timeout. Your weekly fix on finance and investing. This is the Corlin Economics Report.
All right. Welcome back. Continuing to listen to the first hour of the weekend edition of the KE Report. I hope everybody enjoyed those first two segments with Mike Larson. We are switching our focus a bit more directly to the precious metals, maybe resources in particular, and the underlying companies, juniors more specifically, as I am chatting with John Kaiser, founder and editor of Kaiser Research. Now, John, you and I were talking off mic. We actually haven't chatted in the last couple months, and I was just asking you, you know, what do you see for maybe up until the end of the year? It's hard to have a crystal ball right now, but you were even outlining that the next 3 months looking very unpredictable, not just for metals, but for markets, for the world in general, because we don't know what's going to happen with COVID. We don't know what's going to happen with this market recovery or even the potential correction that the markets may have just started on Thursday. John, give us a little summary of why you think now in particular is a very difficult time to be trying to predict market moves and metals moves over the next 3 months.
Well, Corey, in mid-March, we had a pretty sharp drop in markets across the board, including the resource juniors, which were doing quite well in the first quarter. But we've seen markets across the board rebound tremendously. We even have the Dow trying to challenge 30,000, even though the economy continues to be weak. The COVID response has not gotten rid of the COVID problem. We're heading into the flu season in the fall, where people get compressed into closer quarters, and there's a chance that everything will get worse during the final quarter of this year, which is also the election period in the United States. I'm looking at the platforms of both parties, and none of them are really putting out a platform of an agenda for what would they do when they're in charge. Now, to me, the obvious thing that needs to be done is to dig ourselves out of this COVID-induced coma is infrastructure renewal. We'll get this thing behind us. And I'm afraid that really won't happen until 2022. It's probably the earliest before we can talk about COVID being vanquished. So with that recovery out of the abyss in March, the resource juniors did okay. But then in June, they really got traction. And it wasn't just the gold stocks tracking gold's challenge of $2,000. It's also across the board in other categories of companies like nickel and things like that. They have also done quite well. And my own index of, you know, 30 or so favorites, it was up 110% from the start of the year after being down 20% in the March depths. But since early August, the resource juniors have stalled. In June and July, it was tremendous. A lot of money raised. Companies are cashed up. One of the things to worry about is in October, the end of these four-month hold periods happen. So you have these time bombs of stocks that were financed at a cheaper price suddenly getting a liquidity event. But we also have the danger that the overall market could reverse itself. And I saw Al Arian put out an interesting comment that the professionals are afraid to short this market because the Fed has guaranteed that it will keep pumping liquidity into the system. So no short buffer has set up. And if this market reverses course, then the pros will start selling ruthlessly, and there will be no pros covering shorts. So we're entering a danger zone where some random trigger could cause the general markets to reverse. And all of that feeds into the bullish case for gold breaching 2,000, building a new base in the $2,000 to $3,000 range. And that is the underpinning of the awakening of the resource junior bull market. But it's very scary for people like me right now. I can point out lots of stock. These are great ones. They've got money. They've got stories. They've got expiration programs. They've got news coming up. But we also are entering a zone where suddenly everything goes no bid. And then somebody pounds the deep stink bid, paints the tape with that low price, and then triggers a cascade of capitulation selling. It is a truly scary three-month period that we're entering here.
Yeah, fair enough, John. Something similar to March, where everything gets brought down when everyone starts panicking. It doesn't matter what you are in, the share price, the underlying commodity price, the underlying index value is going to fall on its head, just like we saw. Somewhat, though, you can say that some things bounce back quicker, just like the precious metals or, hey, even Apple or something like that. Let's talk about some of the juniors, though, in precious metals, even maybe in some base metals, because even as you outlined, base metals have also been doing a bit better. It seems kind of head scratching to me as copper is over where it was pre-pandemic, but there are a number of reasons for that. When it comes to juniors, a lot of juniors started to rally just a couple months ago, let's say in around June. All of the juniors right now are cashed up. We're going to get a whole slew of drill results and news coming out starting very shortly. What has your attention? Are there any area plays out there? Any in particular drill programs? What, as a barometer, are you following?
Ontario and Quebec, these regions which have high-grade gold potential, they have attracted a lot of capital. And the idea here is not drilling grassroots blind, you know, EM conductors or other geophysical anomalies. It's all about rethinking existing systems, daring to drill deeper, daring to drill laterally, taking what is known and extrapolating it in a geological context to see if there is something much bigger and better there to be found. And that's the key thing that happened in June, was Bay Street suddenly woke up and was in a rush to fund these companies. Anybody that produced any sort of flashy drill results, it was like trolling a big flasher with a little herring attached to it when you're fishing for salmon on the BC coast. Eric Sprott would see the flash and he'd come swimming by and chomp on it. And unlike last year in May when he did this and then looked behind it, you know, he spent $200 million investing in juniors, but nobody followed him into these stocks. This time around, everybody follows him into these stocks that he has put his money into. So I think the appetite, the willingness to respond to good news, this is very different from most of the last 10 years. And even anticipation cycles are working. One of my picks has been SK Mining, which at the beginning of the year had no money. It had that project just south of the original SK Creek deposit. It was languishing at 10 cents. Now it's around 75 cents. They're cashed up. They're drilling on that target. The market is anticipating the benefits of all this rethinking that Quentin Henny and his team, John Dedecker and that, went up there, relogged everything, reinterpreted the geology, undid mistakes previous geologists had done, and came up with a completely new sort of set of targets that have the potential to deliver these eye-catching results. And we just saw this this week with Kodiak Copper, which took an old copper gold play in southern British Columbia that had lots of shallow drill holes in it, but never really put together a coherent open pittable deposit. These guys optioned it fairly cheap, but consolidated the different claim groups and started drilling deeper. They didn't get particularly great results for underground development last year, but this week they reported an intersection, which all of a sudden you say, okay, now they've got the grades deeper that would support a block caving exercise, and people are trading the thing up. It's gone from, you know, 50 cents to as high as $1.90. The project has a sort of $70 to $90 million valuation right now, and the audience is there ready to respond, but they're also ready to respond very brutally if high expectations are destroyed by the truth machine.
Hey, fair enough, right? Let the drill bit lead the stock. But it is encouraging to see the fact, even something like Kodiak Copper, right, releases some good drill holes and the stock just skyrockets higher. I'm actually going to be having Kodiak Copper on the show here shortly to follow up on some of these drill results. But John, is it right now a focus just in good jurisdictions, even the Golden Triangle, where there's a lot of money going into, a lot of drilling happening? That's where investors need to be focused, because it doesn't actually matter where the underlying commodities price goes. If you have some good drill results, that can really help the stock.
Yeah, I'm very much focused on Canada, to some degree the United States, though there the permitting cycle still seems to be a real pain in the butt in some jurisdictions. I'm still waiting for VR Resources to get its permit plan of operations to drill the Big Ten New Legacy. I'm hoping they get their plan of operations to drill the Rift Anticline target. But in Canada, Canada did a much better job than the United States in getting the COVID situation under control. And ironically, things are going slower than people would like in the exploration sector, because Canada continues to really enforce COVID protocols, which makes everything much more sluggish and inefficient than normally. But at least you can get exploration done in Canada. Parts of Mexico are okay, but other parts are not okay. And South America is still very problematic. You know, take Peru, for example. Even though they worked hard to try and contain this, it's still ripped out of control. And of course, in Brazil, they didn't care. They just said it's all BS and let her rip, you know, let the cards fall as they will. Australia is a good place still, but they have tough protocols too. You know, moving around, contact tracing is a huge headache in Australia. But fortunately, Australia is this huge place of wide open spaces where there's absolutely nobody around where you're going to be doing your exploration. But yes, Canada is the jurisdiction. And one thing, you know, I mentioned earlier about the focus on exploration results, this market still isn't getting too excited about optionality, about ounces in the ground. There's a few like Spanish Mountain and its deposit in central BC, where the stock went from 10 cent slumberland up to 50, 60 cents and raised a bunch of money along the way. But in general, the market's not taking $1,900 gold seriously. It still seems to think this is like 2011, when it got to the doorstep of 2000 and then failed, retreated all the way back to 1100. And I think that's a gap in the market's thinking. It's an opportunity. And if I wasn't so worried about a general market meltdown ripping the scaffolding out from underneath these juniors, I would be really pounding the table to load up on these juniors, because somewhere along the way, there's going to be an inflection where people say, ah, no, 2000 is going to be the new base for gold. And it's a question of whether it's 2300, 3000 or whatever going forward. So it's nice to see gold consolidating here in that $1,900 to $2,000 range. It gives people a chance to think about it. We're seeing parties that have historically shunned gold, such as Warren Buffett, embrace it as, you know, this is something one needs exposure to. So I think that the real tsunami that will take this awakening resource junior market, it is still to come. but I think it will come after the election has been decided and we know what we're dealing with for the next 4 years.
All right. Very interesting there, John. I see what you're saying. There is a big disconnect between the stocks and where something like the gold price is trading. But gold really only poked its head above 2,000 for a relatively short period of time. It did reach a new all-time high on the spot market. And this consolidation that we're seeing right in this $1,900 region, this is still very positive. Even if gold goes back to some of the lower projections of the mid to high 1700s, still a very nice market, but these stocks are still generally lagging when you consider where they were about a decade ago. But yeah, the next 3 months, man, oh man, I'm actually not looking forward to it. Just being inundated with even more election news and uncertainty. Undoubtedly so, we're going to see market volatility. But I think that does give us time to focus on the good stories. And quite frankly, Kodiak Copper is a great example of releasing a good drill hole. It was a noteworthy exploration program that they have going on. And they clearly are following through and delivering to the market. And there are some great gains to be had there. John, great chatting with you. Thanks for joining us again on our show. I look forward to chatting with you on a more regular basis. I hope you have a great rest of your long weekend.
It's been a pleasure, Corey, and you have a great weekend too.
To find out more about today's guests, visit us on the web at www.kereport.com. You're listening to the Cortland Economics Report. We'll be back in a moment. Providing unique reporting on markets and companies since 1990. This is the Cortland Economics Report.
All right, welcome back here to wrap up the first hour of the weekend edition of the KE Report. As promised on the first segment, we are ending this hour with a company update from Novo Resources. Novo is traded on the TSX Venture Exchange under the symbol NVO and on the OTCQX under the symbol NSRPF. Chatting with the president and chairman, Quentin Henny. Now, Quentin, just following up on recent news at the tail end of August that discussed the closing of a brokered and non-brokered financing totaling about $56 million Canadian. This all came on the back of the agreement to acquire Millennium Minerals and that so-called Millennium Mill that you and I discussed last interview about a month ago, actually. Give us a little update on this financing, how it came together. You actually raised a fair bit more money than the first announcement, and just how important it is to have this money in the door now, please.
Certainly, yeah. Let's kind of paint the picture here. You know, we're in an exceptional spot now. We're, you know, this is really the juncture where Novo goes from being an exploration company to a producer. And this equity placement that we closed recently, you know, last week was key to that. That provides us a lot of the capital we need. Originally targeted, I think the initial announcement that we upsized to 4 to 2, but we had, you know, very solid interest. Many of our long-term shareholders jumped back in here, so we're very pleased to see that money come in. It also means that, you know, the need to draw down the second tranche of the debt facility that we have with that we're structuring with Sprott Lending is not so critical at this point. So, you know, in our view, it's a more solid foundation to build on, you know, not having that debt component and not taking the risks around that, especially. This, you know, becomes a very, very manageable situation. You know, if you look at our scenario now, we will, you know, close this very shortly. Everything's coming together very quickly at this point. And we will have considerable money in the bank even after making the payment. As part of the acquisition, we will have on the order of 55, maybe 60 million Canadian dollars in the bank. We're doing exploration, of course, so we're, you know, going to continue funding that part too as well. But we have more than enough capital now, or I should say, we have the capital we need to bolt everything together, get Beaton's Creek into production, but also give us the buffer. I guess that's what I mean by more than enough. We you know, it's good to have a bit of buffer right now. Like, you know, COVID, for example, right now it's in control in Australia, has been for some time, you know, but there's always risks around that. So I feel much better. I sleep better at night knowing that we have enough money that we can get everything into production as needed. There won't be any unexpected nasty surprises here.
All right, let's talk about the whole production scenario here at Beaton's Creek. Any timeline that you can give us investors as to when that could be in production?
Yes, sir. Sure. Look, we're targeting in the first quarter of next year to be pouring gold. I think that's easily accomplishable. You know, we are working right now on building our team. In fact, we'll probably have announcements very soon after we announce completion of the transaction. We'll be able to talk about the team we're putting together, and I think it'll make a very good impression amongst you know, our shareholders, but also importantly in Australia. You know, the people that we're bringing in are very high profile, you know, developers and operators that are well respected in the mining industry in Australia, and I think people will understand that, you know, NOAA is going to be a very, very serious gold company going forward. This team, really, just like the acquisition, okay, this is a foundation upon which Nova will grow. Okay, so we do have big aspirations to increase our production over time. We're not going to just, you know, sit still at one asset or one story. We're going to basically unlock the rest of the Pilbara, and this team that we're developing is absolutely first rate, first class. I've been doing interviews and meeting these various people in the evenings, my time. Of course, I'm in Denver here, so I've got to do this from afar, which is an interesting exercise. But I've been absolutely delighted with the people that we're bringing in. I'll be absolutely ecstatic to talk more about these folks once we can announce to the market the members of this team.
So, Crinton, can you remind everybody what the whole production scenario is when this will be first in production, and also provide a little bit more color? As you said, you're not just going to stand pat here. You do see some growth opportunities when it comes to production.
Yeah, so let's paint the picture for the next few months. You know, we're building that team right now. And then, you know, we've already started work, believe it or not. We've started buying some of the equipment we need to, for instance, upgrade the mill. We know that we're going to have lots of gravity gold coming out of our material, so we are enhancing the gravity recovery capacity of the mill. We are doing some work. I kid you not, we're upgrading some aspects of the camp. In the kitchen and so forth. I mean, these are rather mundane things to most investors, you know, probably not the thing that people need to know great detail about, but they are very important that we get these things done so that we're ready to, you know, to move in to basically hit this thing, you know, hit the ground running very, very soon. So over the next few months, you know, we'll have kind of this tandem effort of completing building the team, but also permitting. You know, we have Beaton's Creek permitted, which is good. You know, the mining is actually permitted there. The oxide mining is already permitted. But what we need to do now is, because we have an access to processing, we need to now, you know, obtain permits to dispose of Beaton's Creek tailings material into the tailings storage facility. On the Millennium side, that's a permit that's already been applied for. It will probably take a few weeks to obtain. And then, you know, there's other aspects of the project. For instance, looking at, you know, building the site infrastructure, you know, the haul roads and so forth, as well as, you know, looking at, you know, engaging the contract miner and getting those folks set up. And then, you know, our intention is to start mining a bit, you know, say two months from now or thereabouts, and start stockpiling material over at the mill. We would like to build up an inventory of ore or mineralization at the mill, basically stockpile, you know, a few hundred thousand tons. And that way, when we flip the switch and start production early in 2021, in Q1, we'll have a large stockpile to work with. That'll, you know, get us ahead of the curve. You know, other aspects of the project too, water. You know, we've got very good news in that the bore fields have recharged. The pits are full of water, believe it or not, because of the cyclones last year. So that's a very good situation. We are looking at drilling some new water bores in some of the grounds we've obtained from Mark Creasy recently. These are all very good developments. I think we'll be in an exceptional position around water, like sourcing water. So we won't be hamstrung like Millennium was, throughout most of their lifetime. They always were struggling for sourcing enough water. I don't think we're going to have those kind of problems. So look, we've got a sharp team. They're on it. There's a lot to be done, but the timeline is actually fairly short. I mean, we'll be a going producer here in just a few months.
All right, Quentin, thank you for that comprehensive update when it comes to production. But let's also remind everybody that you guys still have a lot of other land, a lot of other exploration on tap, and money to undertake this exploration. What else is happening in the greater Pilbara area for Novo?
Certainly. Look, as we've talked about earlier this year, we are starting our trial mining phase over at Karratha. This is actually a very important aspect. I'm glad you're asking these questions because this is exactly where our mind is at. How do we grow from here? Okay, so one of the absolute kind of critical things is we take the most advanced assets we have. These are ones we have a great deal of data around, like Karratha, where we've drilled. We drilled 150 drill holes. We have a very good three-dimensional model of the gold-bearing conglomerate, and we have a very good handle on how we would mine that and now process it. Okay, so we've bought our Steiner ore sorting machine. This is a device that can identify gold particles in rock and separate those from waste material. We do anticipate using such a mechanical sorter to produce a very high-grade concentrate at Karratha, which is a really an interesting story, because now you're basically operating this like a gravel operation. You're mining material, you're crushing it, screening it, putting through a sorter, and producing a high-grade concentrate, but you do not have to process the material over at Karratha. You can then put that concentrate into trucks and ship it to the mill at Nulligan, at Beaton's Creek. So, that would be an instant win for us, increased production through, concentrates out of Karratha. We're also obviously looking at how we fast-track Egina. I think the cash flow from the Beaton's Creek operation will help us fast-track Egina into production. It's also, there's a lot of aspects around getting, more cozy with the mines department around permitting mining operations and so forth. And I think that the efforts we're making right now go a long way to show the mines department that we're now becoming a mining company. So things like Egina will actually become easier for us to permit as the mines department becomes more familiar with us, our team, our operating, protocol and so forth. So I think everything's a win. Now, one thing that's a big, big upside for us is the East Pilbara in particular, that, in the vicinity of this mill, say in trucking distance, we have a number of opportunities to take assets that we, currently we'll call it stranded assets. For instance, Tauga Tauga or Virgin Creek or, these other gold projects that really haven't gained much notoriety. We can actually fast track those now through exploration into production and put plan on putting that material through the mill. So these are, definite key aspects of our growth story. And then even at Beaton's Creek, one of the really exciting things, and look, we'll be able to talk about this very soon. We're going to get out there and hit the exploration very hard because we know where there's natural extensions of these conglomerates. And we think there's huge potential to increase the size of the Beaton's Creek resource, really just, basically grow the deposit by leaps and bounds. And that will in itself add quite a few years, potential years to the mine life here, because Beaton's Creek is right next door. So what am I saying? Let's boil it down to the bare basics here. We got Beaton's Creek providing a base load to this mill for the foreseeable future. We've got the immediate add-ons in the East Pilbara, for example, Tauga Tauga. We can truck material in, probably it would be fairly high grade material, maybe 3, 4, 5 gram type material, and put that into the mill stream. We can pull in concentrates out of Karratha. We can use cash flow to fast track things like Egina. These are all huge wins. I would say Novo is a foundation. Novo's going to grow from here. And in a very short while, maybe 2 or 3 years, we will be a mid-tier gold producer that's, you know, Pilbara focused, but producing gold at very high margins. These are all very, you know, potentially very high margin gold deposits. The gold is free milling. It's coarse grain. You know, it's very easy to extract, very high recovery, so forth. I think that that alone is, you know, underpins our whole working hypothesis here that we can build a very high margin gold producer.
All right. Well, Quentin, I can tell that you're excited, and rightfully so. This move into production by the beginning of next year could be huge for the company and all these other opportunities, both within your own land packages and other distressed assets. Like you said, there's a lot of opportunities here for the company, and you've been working for this, through this, for a number of years. It's exciting to follow along with. In full disclosure, I am a shareholder of Novo Resources. We'll keep following along as more news hits the market, but if anybody has any follow-up questions, please email me, fleck@kereport.com. Quentin, I appreciate you taking some time on this weekend show. I thank everybody else for tuning in, and I also thank everybody for visiting our website and our podcast on a daily basis. I keep the content coming because, well, it's an interesting year, and there's a lot to make sense of when it comes to market moves. Everybody, have a great long weekend. Same to you, Quentin. I will be back at it on Tuesday.
Thank you, Corey.